All right, folks, welcome back to Tangential Banter. If you're just joining us for the first time, or if you haven't been around for a while, my name is Ben Mowell, and I'm here with my partner in crime, Jack Korzenowski.
Yo.
Well, we are chugging ahead full steam in season three, and boy, do we have a barn burner of a topic today. This is one that shows up in a lot of different areas of life, I think. So it'll be interesting to flesh that out and see what conclusions we draw.
Barn burner?
Yeah, you're not familiar with the phrase?
Now that I think about it, I think I've heard of it once or twice before, and I think I had it explained to me, but because it was like a one-off thing, I had never heard of it since until now, which I guess is sort of a truism.
Yes.
I forgot. So what does barn burner mean?
A barn burner effectively means something that is really good time. I don't know where it originated. I imagine that, like, if you're having a party in a barn, it gets so out of hand that the whole barn burns down.
Oh, I was going to ask what's so fun about burning a barn down, because that's probably a lot of work you got to do. Maybe if it's somebody else's barn that you don't like.
Maybe. I don't think it was like a vandalistic sort of origin, though.
Like you party so hard, you just burn the barn down.
Yeah, it's like raising the roof, right? Or what are some of the other phrases that mean things are popping off?
Popping
People are having
off
a good
is
time.
one.
Popping off is one. Yeah.
Shoot, I don't know.
Bring the house down,
Oh,
right?
yep, that's another one that's destructive.
There's kind of a handful of idioms there that are
Yeah.
related to building destruction.
Intriguing. But that
So,
is not what we're here to talk about.
that is not. We actually stopped ourselves from going down a tangential banter there. We'll save that for another day because today's topic is very different. And the question that we're going to pose and investigate is, why are humans so fixated on keeping things the same as we find them? So, what do you say? Why are we so fixated?
I guess it depends. So it depends on the context. We had a f the big example that I think sparked this topic when we originally came up with it was the idea of like global warming and environmental change that humans make on the Earth. Particularly nowadays, now that we have so much technology and we can shape the land much more easily and readily now than we've ever been able to do. And there's all, a lot of activists, a lot of resistance to that sort of thing, like global warming, like pit mines, like dams, right? And the thing, if I remember right,
They're called darns or
darns,
dangs, if you
dangs,
prefer.
yes, sorry. That's right, it's a family channel.
Yeah. Apologies to all you families out there who are listening.
So the idea was, and I think it's not just that people think that that stuff's bad. It's the fact that the very often, or at least in my experience, and I would assume yours, Ben, and probably many of the people listening, or excuse me, the person listening, is that a lot of people who are saying, "Oh, we ought not change nature," are the same people who say that, nature changes. Nature changes naturally. Nature develops, it evolves, it adapts. Apex predators, survival of the fittest. So those two things seem to be clashing with one another. If you believe that, humans are not but another animal in Mother Nature, and animals shape their or affect their environments intentionally or not, and that's just the way of things. Why are humans the exception? Or why should we treat them as the exception? If humans are going to destroy the Earth, or at least, detriment it, or degrade it substantially, well, that's just what humans do, right?
Or it's what the animal kingdom does, right?
I mean,
or really any living organism.
Right, but I think a lot of people would argue, oh, well, the animals and plants have a symbiotic relationship with nature. And I would argue, I don't think that's so much the case as much as it is there's just the evolutionary arms race to come up with defense mechanisms or adaptations to get around the fact that other things are doing, you know, certain activities that a given other being doesn't like. And that's not necessarily a good thing. It's just what nature does. So if nature's not doing that fast enough to keep up with humans, then it's like, well, so what? That's just nature.
Nature is naturing itself.
Yeah. This is just what, you know, if nature is going to just naturally by itself turn into a situation where one species gets really smart, really powerful, and destroys the nature for everything else. Don't get me wrong, that sucks from the perspective
everything
of...
else.
Well, it sucks in that, again, I think this is one of those things... Now we're getting... I'm going to devolve. Or not devolve, what's the word? Oh, that's probably the right word. We had a conversation maybe as early as season one about, like, can you have morals without believing in a higher power? Because ultimately, like, who's the authority on what those morals are, right? Is mm-hmm. murder wrong, yes or no? I think most people would say, oh, sure, yeah, murder's wrong. But who makes that decision, right? It's the same thing here. If humans are no different than another animal and they're quote-unquote destroying nature, so what? That's just natural selection. We got so powerful that we can wield nature to our whims. So be it. If we wipe out other animals in the process or other plant life, that's why is that on us for destroying them rather than, well, they just weren't the fittest. They didn't survive. So why is the survival of the fittest okay in all other circumstances, but in this circumstance, it's not? And I think that's I'm going on this seemingly unrelated conversation because I think that is what is at the core. This dilemma is at the core of why people are so persistent on avoiding climate change, avoiding environmental change, and so forth. I don't think that's why people are necessarily persistent against change or persistent in keeping things the same in all circumstances where they're persistent. But just in this, at least this specific example, I think that's at the core of it.
Yeah, so I think what I'm hearing you get at in part is that I would say a lion killing a zebra to feed itself is not inherently an unethical or evil thing. It's not a good thing either, right? It's just what a lion does, and it's how nature works. So nature in and of itself is neither a good or bad thing. It exists and the things in it go about their lives doing what they do, essentially. And now as humanity arrives on scene, we impose an ethical dilemma on nature or upon ourselves regarding nature that isn't there for anything else in a natural system, right? A lion doesn't feel bad that it murders a zebra to eat.
A beaver doesn't feel bad about dinging up a river.
Or chewing down a tree.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that's the crux of where it gets a little bit weird, is to the point you are making. If humanity has become the apex predator, isn't us controlling everything in the world just the nature of what an apex predator does, right? Of I guess managing what it can about its environment to its own benefit.
Yeah.
And I think if you think about it, like for statistically modeling the population of an apex predator, like wolves, for example, those models are essentially built upon what the population of the prey is, right? So the wolf population will continue to expand as long as there's food to eat. And then when their population grows too large as to be unsustainable for the population of prey, then that some of them starve off and the population shrinks back down.
Either
So
starve off or they don't have as many, they don't reproduce as quickly because they're not as healthy
sure.
and yeah.
Yep. So, I mean, from that perspective, you could argue basically that a creature or any species that's at the top of the food chain is going to do everything that it normally does until it reaches a catastrophic level where it can no longer support that population.
Oh, so using the wolf and deer example, I think is a good one. Or just, any population, whether it's the predator prey population balance and war going on, as it were. I think a lot of people would argue, but what you said, right? Wolves and deer, there's sort of natural checks and balances going on where as the wolves get more populous and they start killing off a lot of deer, and the deer start to dwindle. Well, now the wolves are going to dwindle because they don't have enough food to eat, right? So there's sort of like that natural, as I said, a natural checks and balance system going on. And then I think the argument is that humans don't have that because, or I would make the observation humans don't have that because we'll like take captive, would in this case, the wolves, if they were smart as humans, they would take deer captive and then raise them as livestock. And then so that they can actively control the population and have as much food as they want. Why is that bad? Why is
That's a
that
good question.
unacceptable?
That is
Is
a
it
good
just be
question.
is it just because there isn't this checks and balances thing going on? Well, I would argue that there is, because if the wolves have to clear so much farm or clear so much land to keep their deers fed, and that destroys the populations of other animals, and then that causes a chain reaction to where, oh, now the environment can't sustain us. Now all the deer and the wolves are going to die. There's your checks and balance right there. That's it.
And
That's what the checks and balance is.
I mean, going back to the point of like nature, naturing itself is if humanity arrived through natural processes only, then nature essentially has done this to itself, right? It allowed a species to evolve with the brain capacity and means to be able to have this level of domination over its environment. And so it's getting the ultimate apex predator treatment, essentially, right? And in theory, that's not going to be stopped until there is some degradation in the ability of the environment to sustain the population. So going to the climate change conversation, essentially, we can continue pumping out and dumping whatever kinds of chemicals we want anywhere, right? Until the Earth rejects that hypothesis and starts killing off people, essentially.
I want to maybe challenge you to not personify nature, right? Nature didn't allow an apex predator such as humans to come up. Nature wouldn't, what was the word that you said? Oh, re nature wouldn't reject that hypothesis of humans being able to dump everything. It's just the chain reactions that result. You know,
Yeah,
if you
sure.
if you if you take the little
I'm not
what
actually arguing that to be the case. I'm just saying that to prove a point.
Yeah, I know that you don't think that, but I think a lot of people do, that there's sort of like this almost like conscience to nature itself, that and it's doing these things intentionally. And it's think of Newton's cradle. Remember, you know what Newton's cradle is, like the balls on strings, and then you like the rope. Yeah. So if people don't know what Newton's cradle is, you've very likely seen one in your life. You just don't know that's what it's called. It's like the series of,
It's
usually
a
I think, like,
desktop toy.
yep, it's got like the steel balls hanging on strings, and then you raise one up on one end, and then it'll fall down and hit the second one in the chain, and then the fifth one in the chain will go flying, even though the second, third, and fourth don't actually move, right? That happens not because the Newton's cradle has a conscience that says, you know what, this guy sent the first ball flying down, I think I'm going to make the fifth one fly, go flying up. That makes sense. Yeah, fifth ball go flying. You know, it's there isn't some conscious thing delegating that action. And if he's away at it, you know, from his desk, going to the little Newton's Cradles room, that the ball was going to hit and then nothing would happen. You know, it's always going to happen. It's a chain reaction of things that don't get to make decisions.
Yeah, and I think that's a good clarification that if we're talking about a mindless system, there isn't a decision being made, right? And there's not, as such, that's going back to what I said earlier, there isn't an ethic that can be associated to good or bad, really, in the absence of that decision.
And that's the dilemma, right? As far as this nature example goes, people seem to think that this stuff is just happening, you know, naturally, pun intended, but there is a right or wrong way of it.
Correct. Yeah. And I think, so this is where it also gets interesting, is that in my mind, if we wanted to take a natural system and superimpose or project our own mental ethic onto it, then I would say that the natural ethic is survival is good. That seems to be what is rewarded in nature by the system, is survival.
Survival of anything? Like, we want to make sure other things survive too, or survival of just ourselves, everything else be danged?
For any living organism, as an individual, you are rewarded for surviving. And species over time are rewarded for surviving.
What do you mean by rewarded?
That's a fair question. I guess if you die, it's not really a penalty other than the pain of dying, and staying alive might actually amount to more pain than dying. So maybe living isn't a reward.
I don't think it's
from a purely natural perspective.
I think I agree with that, because it's not the reason why it's survival of the fittest and why things do end up, you know, the things that adapt do survive. It's not so much that, again, they're not intentionally trying to say, well, how can we change ourselves to better adapt to our environment? You know, the animals aren't asking that. They're just doing their thing. And if their anatomy isn't suitable, like if they're going to die off either by predators or by the environment, if a mutation doesn't come along to change them in a way that will benefit them, they will die off. That's the end of the story. And I would bet that happens to a lot of species that we don't ever hear about, or, you know, did happen way back when, tens of thousands or millions of years ago, whatever. And it just so happens that sometimes, every now and then, there is a mutation that comes along that is beneficial, that allows them to survive. And then those are the ones that we see.
And I think
survivorship. Also, oh, Ben, it's survivorship bias.
So you're asking the question, what happened to all the things that haven't survived?
No, not necessarily. But I think it's what we see, the observations that we make with the things that survive, the things that come back, the things that we can see, it's sort of lopsided. It's not what you would expect. And you can come to the wrong conclusions because of that. Again, the survivorship bias that we discussed, I think last week or last time or two episodes ago, is a good example of that, right? Why are all of these fighter planes or just planes coming back from the war and they're only shot in these specific areas?
Well, so I don't think what you're saying is incorrect, but I think we can draw the right conclusions from the data that we have, right? It's just, it's a frame of mind, because in that classic example of the planes coming back from, you know, with a bunch of holes in them, they didn't suddenly go recover a bunch of crashed planes with holes in other areas. They just realized that the ones that didn't make it back are the ones that had holes in places that they hadn't documented. So I think in this case, we can correctly say, like, these are the traits that make something survive in this environment without having to go examine the things that haven't survived. I don't know if that's the point you were making, but I think that's a difference here with the whole survivorship bias thing.
Oh no, I agree with your point. I don't think we need to. I think if going back to the warplanes example, right? They came to the right conclusions based on their limited data. So they were
Yes.
ultimately able to come to the correct conclusion based off of the data that they had. And I'm not saying that we can't do that here, but it took them a while and it was unintuitive because they didn't realize at first that their data was skewed, where 100% of their data size represented not just a random distribution of the whole population, but a specific sect of it. And then the data, there were no data points in the other from the other parts of the population, because none of those data points ever, well, I got to be careful how I say this. None of those population exam or iterations stuck around long enough to be observed. So what I'm saying is the animal kingdom today, we could be facing a survivorship bias problem where everything that we see now, we may think is just a random snapshot in history. I mean, and it is to an extent, but it's probably only giving us one piece of the pie as far as how things evolve. Because I think so many instances of nature shows and documentaries I've seen make it seem like evolution is like an intentional process or a designed process, which is sort of ironic, when they reject a designer in the first place. But that's beside the point. What I'm trying to say is it's not, I don't think it really is like this directed movement. I think all these mutations and changes are just happening at random, and they're probably as often as they're beneficial, they're probably just as often bad for the race, and it kills that species off even faster, and then we never hear about them again. So then the only ones that survive are the ones that develop mutations. So the only animals we see are animals that developed in plants that developed beneficial mutations and evolved. So then we see, oh, look at this. 100% of the animal kingdom all developed beneficial mutations and adapted over time to help them evolve. So that must be the general trend of evolution. I don't think so. And it may be the theory of evolution doesn't say this. Maybe it says what I'm already saying, and I'm just reinventing the wheel. But because the animal and plant kingdom, just life in general today, every single example would show a trend of its change over time to meet the challenges of the environment. It seems like it's a one-way street that it naturally only went in that direction, because there. What really happened, likely, is my theory is that there are animals or back in time, the species evolved in another direction. Maybe there was, whatever mouse-like animal eventually evolved into the bat. Maybe there were other examples that mutated so that they had the went in the opposite direction, short, stubby legs, and they couldn't run very fast, not I mean, let alone even fly. But what would happen? They just got eaten up right away. They got killed and then died off. So what
So,
we, I've been talking long enough. You go
well,
ahead.
so what I would say on that point is that maybe that could be true with neutral mutations, but mutations like that, like short stubby legs that you can't run away, those so negatively impact your survival ability that they wouldn't be propagated into a like a new species sort of thing.
That's my point.
Well, yeah. So
So
what I'm what
50% of the mutations in this example, 50% of the mutations developing wings versus developing wings is one mutation, developing short stubby legs is another. There are two mutations, but the second mutation was so detrimental that it survived for so little that we only see, hey, look, these mice developed wings to fly, and then, oh, look how ingenious this evolutionary system is. No, it's not. I wouldn't say it's ingenious. It's just throwing a ball of spaghetti at the wall, and then one noodle will stick. And then you come back, some guy comes up to the wall and says, "Wow, you managed to get one noodle stuck on the wall? That's impressive, man." I would, for me, I'd have to throw a whole handful at the wall to do that. Say, well, yeah, that's what I did. You're just seeing the one noodle that's still up there because all the other ones fell to the ground and then I ate them, which is why you can't see them right now.
Number one, you need to cook your noodles longer if they don't stick to the wall. Number two, why are you eating noodles that fell on the floor?
I'm not going to waste the noodles, man. You know, gives them some character, toughens you up. You know, that's how kids get strong immune systems when they're young.
You prefer floor noodles?
Hey, I clean my floors.
Okay. So what I was going to say is, in my mind, it's helpful to think of that process like a massive tournament bracket. And for any, you could draw this out however you wanted, but you could say that there's two competing traits, like the short stubby legs versus the wings thing, right? In the first generation. And we'll say that the short stubby legs don't improve survivability. So all the specific individuals in that population with short stubby legs die off, and the ones that have wings survive. Well, in the next generation, there's another mutation. We'll say it's a longer snout. And then it's, you know, the wings versus a longer snout, or snout and long, or longer snout and wings versus just a longer snout, right? And then those pair off. So over the generations of mutation, it's like you were saying in the hypothetical, 1v1, it's a 50%. But when you end up, those truly successful mutations over time are going to have a string of, you know, dozens or hundreds or millions of mutations that didn't succeed that they've beat out over time, right? As the more useful trait. And so I would agree, there's this, the history books are going to be littered, or the fossil record littered with all the unhelpful mutations, or the ones that were helpful, but not as helpful, whatever. But I think what's interesting is that if you think of it like this massive tournament bracket over time, if the environment was unchanged, if there weren't any changing parameters, you would say that over time, the competition is getting tougher, right? You're getting more, fit species, the more fit traits for any given environment are becoming more entrenched. They're getting stronger, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the unaccounted for variable is how the environment changes around those adaptations, right? Because it may change in a way that's disadvantageous for the new form that you have. But I guess what I want to get to, and maybe turn the corner in the conversation here a little bit, is, you know, we're talking about keeping things the same, and why is it bad for humans to essentially be dominant over all the other species? And I think it's interesting because, I guess from what I see, it's not even human domination over the planet or over other species, I think in general, is viewed negatively. But I would say that there are also, especially if you're talking about like endangered species, we also, speaking in broad terms here, want to prevent the extinction of any species, whether it's human caused or not. And so it's like, obviously human causes of species extinction is a fairly large portion, but it seems like we fight tooth and nail to prevent even the natural extinction of a flower, or, you know, like you were saying, some kind of special mouse somewhere or whatever. So we, even where there's a purely natural phenomena at play that's causing the extinction of a less fit species in that environment, we still want to intervene and try to like freeze time and keep this thing that was, without our intervention, would have completely perished of natural causes. And yet we say, oh, that's bad, right? We shouldn't allow this flower to go extinct. We shouldn't allow this mouse to go extinct. We try to preserve basically every species that has been, we try to preserve at the point where we encountered it. And I think that fundamentally is where, I guess we, in my mind, we encounter humanity's ego or hubris, is that there can be these natural processes occurring anywhere that we don't observe, and that's okay. But as soon as we encounter it, it has to be stuck in the state that we found it, and we consider that to be the right way, is whatever it was when we encountered it, and then it needs to stick that way.
Is your okay, so that I think that's a much more interesting scenario to talk about, because I agree that the human tendency is, oh, this animal is about to go extinct, we have to save it. Whether that extinction is human caused or not. I'm guessing that if it were human caused, the outcry would be even stronger, because again, there's like this persistence, oh, we don't want to, dominate and shape the environment so much to where these animals are going extinct. What caught my eye or my ear is that you said it was hubris that humans would try to stop it. And is that purely from a like if like a secular perspective?
I said that because it's like, how do we as a species, even if we are conscious and sentient, how are we, from a natural perspective, how are we the arbiters of which species get to survive and which ones don't? Right? So if you're on an island somewhere, isolated and perishing because you can't adapt to survive in the environment, why would we think it's good or right to intervene in that scenario and prevent a species from becoming extinct when that's just the natural order of life, is that some species are extinct and then other ones come along, right?
A natural order that probably the very same person would laud as some beautiful process. And then when they see it happening in front of them, they want to go in and stop it all of a sudden.
I mean, that's conjecture, but I wouldn't disagree that there are people out there who hold both views.
Well, I mean, like the survival of the fittest, right? I think a lot of people would laud that and say that it's a beautiful thing that nature does, because then things can improve and adapt and change and say, okay, well, here's something that isn't fit and it's going to die, and now we should just go let no, we have to save it. Well, you just said survival of the fittest is the best thing, but not in this case, because, and then
Sure.
that's where the it's kind of, I don't know what their response would be.
Yeah,
I would say their tendency to want to save things and to protect the environment, just in the whole, or just nature, is that inborn instinct to be stewards of the earth that we were given as humanity. And then that would be the explanation. So I think that's a sign, it's a fingerprint of the creator on our hearts to go out and protect. So it's, but then when you say there is no creator, this is all just natural. This is just how nature works. But then you go out and also say humans are just another animal, and then say, but when animals are acting like other human, or when humans are acting as other animals, it's bad. That's the disconnect for me. Another thing, and we don't have to go down this road. I think it's also a disconnect that when people say that there is a creator and we were put on this earth to, subdue it and to be stewards of it, and then they don't follow through, and they are, littering, and they are saying, yeah, but cut down the forest to build more, I don't know, shopping malls or something, or they just don't care. I think that's also backwards. So we have both sides of the aisle are backwards. The
Yeah.
people who don't believe in a creator are behaving as if there is one, and that humans do have a responsibility to take care of the earth. And then the people who do believe in a creator, the stereotype is that they don't care about nature and aren't protecting the environment, even though their creator told them to do that. It's a beautiful irony. I don't know if beautiful is the right word. And it's the same way, like a, I don't know, a sinking ship is something that it's like a marvel, just seeing this giant, I don't know,
I would call it a
monument.
dark irony.
Yeah, it's a dark irony, a dark irony,
Yeah.
which also makes sense that it would be backwards, but.
And so I think that's that kind of goes back to where we started in the sense that feeling any remorse over the death of, I guess what would be considered your prey in an environment is counter to the natural order, right? Because it does not benefit a lion to feel remorse for eating a zebra, right? It needs to eat the zebra to survive. So any like, oh, the poor zebra, or I'm causing zebras to go extinct. That thought, if lions were capable of it, would not be helpful for a lion's survival. And so the fact that humanity, an individual human or humanity in general, can have this sense that, oh, we need to care for nature, we need to prevent things from going extinct, we need to prevent ourselves from damaging or destroying our environment or these other species, that is completely the opposite of how essentially every other species in the world operates.
Think somebody could come in with a counter argument and say, well, humans, their protection of the environment may just be more have more selfish motivations. We want to keep it the same, not because we value the environment as something that needs to be protected for its own sake, but because we want to keep the environment around as our pet, as our tool, as it were. Like if we ruin the environment, we're going to run out of food, we're going to run out of places to live, people are going to starve and die and be miserable. We want to protect ourselves from that, and the way to do that is to make sure that nature can keep providing its fruit for us. So really, it's if somebody wanted to argue that humans are only protecting the environment to keep it around sort of like as a piece of livestock, not because you value the cow for the sake of the cow deserves to live and to live a happy life, but because, well, yeah, I want to keep it well now so that I can slaughter and eat its meat later.
I definitely have heard the argument made that like, oh, I want to protect whales or elephants or whatever so that my grandkids will have the ability to see these majestic creatures alive one day, right, in the wild. I've heard that argument made.
So it's just for the sake of the animal. Not because we can get some benefit out of them, is what you're saying?
And in a sense, it's like it's a zoo mindset in the wild.
Right.
It's like we want to have this collection of all these bizarre creatures for us to enjoy. So like, oh, I can still go out and see a giraffe in the Serengeti or whatever, right? Like, oh, that's such an amazing experience, which sure it is. But again, that's less about the animal's welfare than it is about our own benefit from it.
Now, if somebody were to, but so I want to finish this thought. If somebody were to make this argument that people are really only protecting the environment so that we can benefit from its, reap its fruit, no other animal, as far as I'm aware, does that. A wolf does not say, you know what, I'm a little peckish right now. I see a deer, I know I can get it, but you know what? I know if I kill that deer, that's just going to be one less deer to reproduce. So, I'm going to let it go. I'm going to let it go so it can make more deer babies. So then we'll actually have more deer to eat later. No wolf thinks
Right.
that. No lion thinks that about a zebra. No eagle thinks that about fish. They just see a fish, say, "Hey, I'm going to eat it."
And I think that brings up two points. So one of them is we've talked several times about the lack of ability that humans have to connect their current behaviors, like current bad behaviors that they themselves would say are bad, to a future outcome, right? So a classic example being, eating food that we know is unhealthy, which we know leads to, obesity or diabetes or whatever, any number of health issues that you want to say down the line. And yet we still, across the whole swath of humanity, struggle when food is available to not eat it, even though we know that long term it leads to our detriment. So it's like that same instinct of the wolf just eating whatever prey it can find because it can and it's hungry is the same thing. And it really the only thing limiting them is the food supply, right? If there was an infinite supply of deer, you better believe there would be some massive wolves out there.
Yeah, unless they were so heavy that they couldn't even chase the deer down anymore.
Right. And which would be problematic for them and hasn't yet become problematic for us as a species because
We just
we've
invent
isolated them.
little ghost scooters so you can drive around and pick up your
Yes.
cookies and chips, yeah. So
And the other, before I forget, the other piece that I wanted to add, and this goes back to something you said early on, is that there is also this argument of like symbiotic relationships in nature, where two species work together for mutual benefit. And I think that's often pointed to as in this example of like, oh, this is how a individual or a species is caring for this other one. And it's like, we have to be careful with that because the why are they caring is important, right? When like in in Africa, they're often mixed species of herds. So the example that we learned when we were over there was zebras and antelope, I think, often are blended together. And I don't remember which way it was. I think it's that antelope have really good eyesight and zebras have good hearing. And so between the two of them, if they were separate herds of antelope and zebra, even though they're competing for the same resources, they would be less effective at identifying incoming lions or cheetah or whatever, right? But when there's a blended herd, they've got the combined eyesight and hearing, and so they're able to detect those predators sooner. And so it's like, I think that's a really cool thing that they've learned over time how to protect themselves more effectively, but it's not like the antelope are saying to zebras, boy, we really like you guys. You're so awesome, and we want to make sure you survive, so we'll be your eyes, right?
Right.
It's like, no, you guys will be our ears because we want to survive. And
Okay. I see. And here's the thing too, right? It wasn't an intentional thing that the antelope and the zebra intermixed. It's not like the antelope sent a representative over and said, "Hey, we've noticed you guys have really good hearing, but we know that we have better eyesight than you. You wanna team up? You be the ears, we be the eyes." And the zebra said, "Hold on, let me go take it back to my guys, and I'll get back to you." What likely happened was that there were antelope that saw zebra, and then said, "Ooh, I don't like those. I'm going to stay away from them." And then there were some antelope where their genetics made them more disposed to being okay with being around zebras. "I don't really care. Sure, I'll run with them. I'll drink with them. I'll eat with them. Whatever." Those groups just did their thing. The antelope that were okay with zebras just went over to the zebras. The antelope that didn't like them stayed away. And then the same thing happened with zebras, right? Some didn't like the antelope or skittish. Some of them were okay with them. There's three groups: zebras by themselves, antelopes by themselves, and then the antelopes and the zebras together. The first two herds got killed off by the lions. So the only ones that are around are the ones that were working not working together that were herding together. So it's
yep.
not like they intentionally it's, but here's the thing, right? Going back to the survivorship bias, we as people in the fossil records or just observing their behavior what we would see in the evolutionary record is that there were zebras and then there were antelope, and then over time they started commingling for protection, and then we may infer there was some sort of intentionality about it, or the antelopes learned that the zebras hear better, or that the zebras learned that the antelopes see better, and then they started to intentionally intermix to seek out protection. No, that's not what would have happened. And again, I'm not a biologist, I'm not a zoologist, I'm just some dude ranting. So forgive me if I'm
So,
getting things a lot of things wrong. And if you want to rebut with actual like documentation saying I'm wrong, 100% for it. I just want to put that disclaimer out there. But here's my point about the survivorship bias. We would see over time in the fossil records, antelope and zebra slowly starting to commingle and then maybe infer that one or both of them learned something about each other and then intentionally started commingling. No, it's just that the ones that they just started commingling almost incidentally, and then the ones that didn't commingle died off. And they died off fast enough and didn't have enough time in the fossil record to be a distinct enough group that we didn't really notice them.
So I think that goes back to what you called out earlier of the anthropomorphizing, right? To say that a species learned something and then started interacting. If you were gonna use anthropomorphism, it would be more accurate to say that the genes of the zebras or the genes of the antelope learned how to commingle rather than the species or the individuals themselves.
Right.
It's still not necessarily accurate, but it's, I think, more representative of what actually occurs in those scenarios.
One last thought, because I know we're kind of starting to run low on time, and there is one other example to the original topic I wanted to bring up, wholly unrelated to the one we're talking about now, that I know you're going to be very passionate about, as am I. And I'm sure many of our listeners as well. The last thing I want to have is herd animals, right? They herd together for protection. I'm sure that there were antelope, zebra, water buffalo, whatever, or bison, that like individuals that when they were born had a mutated gene that made them less disposed to being in herd, where they did want to be more solo. So then they would wander away and then be on their own more often than not. And you can probably guess what happened to them. They died. They were eaten. They were singled out. They singled themselves out and they were hunted down and killed. They couldn't pass that gene along. So the ones that had the genes that did have the predisposition to stay herded together are the only ones that survived to this day. It's not an intentional choice. It's not like the buffalo learned anything or that the genes actively adapted to, hey, we should start herding together. Let's start producing bison that herd together. It's just that the mutations happened randomly, but only some of those mutations led to benefits that allowed those genes to get passed on. So evolution to me seems like it's a much more intentional thing than it really likely is. I think it's really just a bunch of random dice rolls. And every now and then, hey, this gene is going to get passed along more. So that's I'll capstone my part of the conversation with that. So go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think in that example, I'll state an argument again, no idea if it's factual or not, but it seems that in general, like you were saying that in the past, maybe there were zebras or whatever that had genes that made them more disposed to wander off. I would argue that those types of mutations are always happening. And right now, the behavior of any given specific species of zebra or even in a specific environment is governed by the relationship of how well those zebras that are predisposed to wander off can survive on their own. And so if there were to come a time where there was less predator pressure from lions or hyenas or whatever, you would probably see a variation of zebras that behave less as a herd. There's more individualistic behavior because they're capable of surviving on their own over time. And there is a built-in penalty for any set of individuals. The closer they stay together, they are restricted in the amount of resources that are available for them, right? Unless they relocate, the population density for any given area is going to limit the number of resources that are available to them. So I think in general, life wants to spread out and find space. And the only reason it would constrain itself to operate as a herd is when there is that predator pressure that prevents it from being able to spread out and find additional resources. So it becomes this balance of maximizing the amount of resources available to you in the given space while minimizing the threat from predator pressure. So, were you changing topics entirely or just.
Subtopic. So it's still related to why are people so insistent on keeping things the same?
All right, well, go for it.
Why in the world are companies so fixated on getting people back in the office?
That is not the direction I thought you were going to go, but.
Why, when so many companies in the span of everybody working from home during COVID reported record earnings, are saying now we need to get back in the office? For crying out loud, it's not like just things stayed the same or got marginally worse, and then you could easily consider that to be from the pandemic and not from people working from home. Why is it like, hey, we made this change, everybody started working from home, and we saw an increase in profits? Wow, we should totally bring them all back so we can make even more money. That doesn't make any sense. Why? Like, you'd think companies, and maybe companies aren't as driven by profit as we think. Maybe they're just dumb. Because if there is an
See,
opportunity to get more profits and there's a mechanism to enable that, why aren't they taking absolute, why aren't they like forcing people to work from home in that case? I don't understand it.
I think my opinion on this is that they're afraid that if everyone's working from home, well, there's two pieces. So the individual managers are afraid they're going to lose control. And for many of them, for those who are managers, they are already past the midway point in their career. They came up through the ranks working in the office. So working in the office is the only way they know to work, and it's the only way they know to manage. And so their comfort zone is having people at their desks day in and day out. That's where they're comfortable. So that's the people side of it. From the business or organizational side of it, I think most companies are afraid that if we go to a fully remote work environment for those jobs where it's possible, that, and I don't think this is incorrect or a phobia. I think it's a valid fear, is that it would cause a flattening of the competitive environment for companies nationwide and even globally, right? Why, if I can work remotely for 200 companies, why wouldn't I apply to work for somewhere like a tech company in the Bay Area, right? If I don't have to live there and pay $200,000 a year for a house or whatever, right? Like, why would I not take the opportunity? So I think it's comparing this to our predator prey sort of thing. I think a lot of companies are worried that having their employees out of the office means they lose their competitive edge and control over the opportunities that those employees have. Because as long as you're in the office, as long as you're tied to a physical location, they know a lot of people aren't going to want to pull up stakes and relocate. And so the incumbent employer has a massive advantage over someone who's not in the immediate area and in a similar price range, right? Even somebody who's willing to offer you more money, they've got to be able to upset or offset your losses of moving costs and rebuilding your social circle and being, farther away from family or friends, whatever it might be, whatever those other penalties are outside of work. And so if everybody's working remotely, suddenly a lot of those barriers disappear. And you could be, working for a company in Boston one day, and you could be working for a company in Florida the next, and they have no real advantage.
I understand that fear. Like, I get that. But if you're a company who is working remote currently and you want to make the push to working back in the office, you're only shooting yourself in the foot if that's what you're afraid of. Because now
Because other companies are going to do it.
it's not like other companies are going to also force her to, oh, XYZ company is forcing their employees back into the office. Oh, I just got a letter from the CEO. Hey, ABC Limited, can you please make your employees work from home? Because I'm afraid that when I make my company employees work from home, they're going to go to you because you're letting your employees work remotely. Thanks, bye. That doesn't happen, right? If we work for Deere, if Deere all of a sudden said everybody's got to come back in the office, it's not like there aren't other companies where we could just say, well, screw it, I'm going to quit Deer and go work at another place.
Yeah.
Right? So, and I was just speaking to somebody who had that experience, not with Deer, but they said that the company I was working at was going to force me to go back in the office. So I, which I didn't want to do.
Wait, was this a Twitter employee?
No, which I don't want to do.
Oh.
So I got a job with another company that pays me more, and I'm 100% remote. So that first company being afraid, if they were, are truly afraid of what you the what you proposed, they only made that fear tr like fulfill itself.
Yeah.
It's sort of like if you're
Yeah.
so afraid, like if you're up on a high, if you're up on a high height and you're afraid of heights and you're afraid you're going to fall and die, that you're so afraid of it that you I don't like you scramble to the ladder in a very unsafe, haphazard way and end up falling off. It's like, dude, by acting on your fear of the thing that you were afraid of, you ended up experiencing the thing you were afraid of. So it's like a circular, it's a
It's a
circular logic.
self-fulfilling
It's a,
prophecy.
it's, it, well, it's just, it, yeah, kind of, because like by, if you just weren't afraid of it, you wouldn't experience it. It's an ironic thing. By being afraid of the thing, or more specifically, by acting on the fear of the thing, you experience the thing that you're afraid of. And if you didn't actually act on that fear, you wouldn't experience it.
So, one final thought on that topic, which is actually my fear in response to that, is. And I think this eventually is going to happen no matter what, is that we're going to transition from becoming an economy where people are working for an employer and have a stable job to becoming much more contract based. And so I think long term, even engineers may develop an expertise in a specific area, and you'll be hired for as an independent contractor for a specific project to bring your expertise into that area. And we're going to continue to see an erosion of stability related to employment, which for some people maybe isn't a big deal, but I think will be significant in terms of how it impacts society. If you're, changing employers every couple of years, even if you're not changing locations, right? And maybe, if you prove yourself, you'll be hired back for more and more contracts, but. And then again, even though that's something that I fear could become a reality, I don't know that that reality is necessarily bad. There's things that I think I can see downfalls to it, but there may also be upsides that I haven't thought about yet. So I do need to put a pin in this because I'm up against a time constraint. But one thought I was going to add back on the nature side of things, we talked a lot about species and stuff like that. But I think this also applies in terms of climate change. And obviously, we want to, at a minimum, have a place that's habitable for us to live for our lifetimes, right? And in a best case scenario, for multiple lifetimes after that. But on the flip side, we're actually, based on the historical record, we're not even anywhere near as hot on average as what the planet has been in the past. And so I think it's also interesting that we're fixated on keeping the temperature the same as it was, say, 200 years ago, even though we're maybe approaching or around what the average has been over the life of the Earth. And I've joked about it this way, of that, like, if we crank the temperature up a couple more degrees, will we get dinosaurs back? Because that'd be kind of cool.
No, there was a whole book and movie series about why that's a bad idea.
Well, that's if you grow them out of a lab. If the earth, poops them out itself, then we may be okay.
Because it's natural, right? Then it's okay.
Yeah, and
Man-made bad.
then we as a species would go extinct the natural way
Yep.
because the dinosaurs ate us. Maybe
Dude, they
that's
had.
secretly why people don't want the temperature to change. We don't want to get eaten by T-Rexes.
Dude, they had war elephants back in the day. Can you imagine having like riding into battle on the back of a Tyrannosaurus Rex?
Have you ever read the books, the Dinotopia series?
No.
You should check those out. They're like young adult books, but they're illustrated, and it's I guess I'd call it a fantasy series based on the premise of like humans coexisting with dinosaurs and almost kind of like the alien, I can't remember what they're called, the Na'vi riding the dragons or whatever in Avatar.
Oh, I haven't seen Avatar.
Well, so it's like, okay, it's imagine a person riding a pterodactyl, right, with
Sure.
like a saddle and a harness and stuff,
Oh, it'd
or
be
like
cool.
you're saying, T-Rexes. They're fascinating books. I actually have been I've had them in my wish list for a long time to get a copy because I want to read them again, but
What happened to the copies you originally read?
oh, I got them from the local library when I was a kid.
Ah. Hey, maybe you can do that again.
I could. That's true. That's true. But we are at the end of our available time, so I'm going to cut
Indeed.
it off
All
with a
right.
hard stop today.
All
But
right, man. It was good. It was real.
real good.
Hope everybody enjoyed it. And again, if we said stuff about evolution or just nature stuff in general that's wrong, hey, rebut. Again, we're just two random dudes who are just speculating on a bunch of stuff and using
But
our
not the
own.
stock market. We do not speculate on the stock market.
Right.
But also, not even rebuttals. If you have ideas, little brain teasers, shower thoughts, things that you like to share that you think would be interesting to have us hash out, feel free to send those our way as well.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll talk to you next time.